Dog Works Radio Network presents Mushing Radio, hosted by Robert Forto. Mushing Radio is about dog-powered sports, living in the Great White North, and mushing. Visit our website at mushingradio.com. Here is your host, Robert Forto.
Hello and welcome, everybody. You're listening to Mushing Radio here on KBRF 89.5 in the Mattsu Valley. RadioFreePalmer.org is our live streaming site, and you can find all of our episodes over on DogWorksRadio.com as well as on iTunes and Twitter. Today we're talking with our co-host today. His name is Alex Stein, calling in from Southern California. Alex, how's it going?
It's going great, Robert. Very much spring here, and from looking at the pictures, I think it's kind of spring up there as well.
It is a beautiful day here in Alaska, especially up here in Willow. We have the bees buzzing around, and the yard is drying up. Looking forward to all those summer projects.
Excellent. Yeah, and I know there's a lot of stuff to keep people occupied and keep people, very, very busy, even in the off season.
That's right. So, Alex, today we're going to talk to a journalist up here in Alaska. His name is Craig Medred. He's calling in from Anchorage. Craig, are you there?
I'm here in Anchorage where
hey,
it's
Craig,
summer.
It is summer. You know, thank you for joining us again on the show. You know, you were on our show, I don't know, maybe 3 or 4 years ago when your book Graveyard of Dreams came back. And it's a joy to welcome you back. Thanks for joining us.
Well, thank you. It's good to be here.
Likewise.
Go ahead. Sorry about that. I was going to say, for people who don't know, Craig has covered the Iditarod and covered a lot of different areas in Alaska. But I got to know Craig from his work in the old Alaska Dispatch, and always had great and insightful things to say about dog mushing and especially about the Iditarod. So I have to say, Craig, it is a pleasure to welcome you to the show today.
Well, thanks. It's a race that's changed a lot over the years.
Yeah, and one of the things that we wanted to talk to you about is people might remember that there was a story about a snow machiner who apparently was drunk, I believe admitted that he was drunk, who attacked King and Ali Zirkel during the race. Then you had broken a story a few weeks after that about possible additional snow machine attacks. And one of the reasons we wanted to have you on today was you had, I believe, been the first person to write about Travis Beals and domestic violence, which then I think largely as a result of your story and that story being picked up by several other media outlets eventually led to the Iditarod suspending him. I'm not sure what the right term is, suspending him for next year and keeping him out of the race until he meets certain requirements.
Yeah, that's correct. I mean the whole thing kind of fits into an Alaska with endless problems, which most of us who see the Iditarod only see the good side, and there are all sorts of other issues up here, kind of some of them endemic to northern climate, some of them endemic to lack of sunlight, and some of them just, it's a tough place to live up here. People sometimes get pretty emotionally fragile. I feel sorry for Beals. Training for Iditarod's it's a hugely stressful thing, and if other things aren't going well, that stress on top of whatever else is going on in your life, I can see unsettling even somebody who's coping normally pretty well.
I was wondering, Craig, what was your impression about the reaction that happened after you published your story? I know there were a lot of people who were very, very critical of you for even bringing this up.
Well, there are a lot of people who don't. We kind of live in a state of denial here with Iditarod. There are issues none of us want to talk about. I kind of got into some of those the other day in a very, very upbeat story about a rescued dog who turned out to be a first-rate sled dog. But, I mean, the backstory on how he came to be a rescued dog is, you know, some wannabe musher abandoned a litter of starved puppies at the pound in Fairbanks, which is, you know, something we don't talk about, but we probably have too many of those people who come up here to Alaska with the dream of being a musher and never really get it off the ground and collect a bunch of dogs they can't afford to feed. And, I mean, we just kind of have these, you know, dark side of life in Alaska stories that people don't want to deal with. And I've just, yeah, I don't know, but I guess I can blame my parents who kind of, you know, raised me that other people's problems are your problems and that things don't get better by keeping them in the dark. So it was a no-brainer to me that when we had someone who had been convicted in relation to a domestic violence case, who was pending trial on another domestic violence charge, whose partner was running in the same Iditarod, it just was obvious to me that, you know, this question comes up of should Iditarod be condoning this, which is essentially what they're doing by allowing them to run, and one thing led to another, and I think most of the reaction was positive. I think most people were of the opinion, you know, this isn't a good idea, you should go tell them to go home and get their problems straightened out. But there were people who, you know, it's not Iditarod's problem, Iditarod shouldn't deal with this. You know, how people behave when they're not running Iditarod is nobody's business but their own, which kind of reflects a long, old Alaska tradition of live and let live, which I tend to share. I just think this problem is so big in Alaska, it's one you can't treat it that way.
Right.
Craig, if I could here, Craig, since we're so far away, Alex and I, we sometimes stumble over each other. But I have a quick question for you in regards to, you know, the storytelling of sports. And I know you do a great job of behind-the-scenes stuff. You know, when you're watching Sunday Night Football during the football season, there are folks that are watching the game for the game itself, and then there are folks that are watching it for the stories, the behind-the-scenes, you know, off-the-field type stuff. And, you know, Al Michaels and Chris Collinsworth are often interweaving these stories along with the sporting event. And, you know, the Iditarod has always been about these stories, but until recently, in particular with social media, we often didn't hear these stories until well after the fact. So my question to you is, how is storytelling changing the way people are interpreting the Iditarod than they used to before?
Oh, man, that's a bigger question, I think, than the Iditarod. I think that's changing. I mean, it's changing everything, including the way the Iditarod gets covered. It you know, it used to be you'd be the lone reporter out there with a bunch of mushers. Everyone was pretty isolated. There were, you know, communications were bad for the presses that existed. You know, the story was very much filtered through whatever reporter happened to be in a checkpoint to report things. Now there are myriad reporters. There are people who live there, Facebook filing. There, you know, it's, I mean, reporting in general has changed so dramatically, even in the last 5 years, with all the people
right.
so active on Facebook reporting from the scene of whatever they're seeing that, you know, it kind of amazes me that I have colleagues in journalism who ignore Facebook and Twitter, and I don't know how you can. I mean, it's just become such a part of the game in terms of information gathering that, you know, often you're getting better information there than you are from the authorities who are like reporters used to be, still trying to control the flow. It's hard to even, I mean, the only thing we're really missing is story these days, because it used to be reporters got all the information, kind of put it into a story, and nobody's quite figured out how, at the faster pace we're operating, to take all that kind of Facebook gibberish, make it into a story so you can take it to other people. It's an interesting time to be a journalist. I mean, there's no money in it. You know, I'm running a website, craigmedrud.news, that isn't making any money, but I'm not losing, you know, the $6 million a year that the Alaska Dispatch is. So I guess I'm lucky. But it really has changed. It's changed a lot. And it's interesting because when I did my first Iditarod back in the 80s, I mean, it was really hard in most places to get stories out. You know, the south of the Alaska Range, there were no electronic communications, so you had to handwrite it and hand it to a pilot, and he'd fly it back. And north, the phone service was very spotty, so you usually phone stories and often dictated them. And now it's just, I mean, it's incredibly easy to move, you know, not only stories, but I can sit in a Rainy Pass Lodge and send back photograph after photograph over their internet connection. It's so different.
It is. So, Alex, next question for Craig there.
Well, you know, Craig, I was wondering, your story has sort of raised a larger question about how much should an organization like the Iditarod Trail Committee be regulating the people who compete. And I've heard a lot of people talking about, you know, for example, that there are mushers who have had drunk driving convictions, mushers who have had various, you know, small and large run-ins with the law, use of marijuana, for example.
It's legal now in Alaska, so that's not an issue anymore.
Right. But how much do you think an organization like Iditarod should be involved with looking into the background of people? Should there be background checks?
I think the first answer to that question is another question. And that question is, what does Iditarod want to be?
Right.
I mean, if Iditarod really wants to grow the organization and be a, you know, a professional sport in terms of being bigger and more visible and all that, well, I can tell them how to do that, and that's you create Iditarod mushers who are personalities of a size that people are interested in them for more than, you know, 10 days in March. They become, you know, nobody's going to become the Tiger Woods of dog mushing, but they become, you know, personalities as big as the sport, so you can use them to sell the sport. Well, if you want to go that route, then people are going to have to clean up their acts. Because there's certain things that just don't sell well in America. I mean, it's fine to have an outlaw mix in there and a Lance Mackey probably works because all of the stuff he does is relatively minor and he can't quite stay out of trouble, but it's kind of, you know, fashionable that he doesn't stay out of trouble. But, you know, once we get into serious, serious domestic violence issues and stuff like that, well, you can't, if you're going to be public and grow the thing, you can't, I don't think, at least, maybe you can, but I don't think you can have those kinds of people out there representing the race. On the other hand, you know, if we just want to go back to being a little kind of, you know, blip on the radar that comes up every winter in Alaska, you know, probably most of that stuff you can ignore.
Right.
So, I mean, you know, that's kind of been a fundamental question for Iditarod for the last, you know, maybe 10 years of what does it want to be? Do we want to be, you know, a professional race, a semi-professional race, an open-to-anybody race? You know, we've increasingly kind of cranked the qualifying standards down to get more, for lack of a better word, professional. We've gone a long way from what Joe Reddington thought it should be, that was like a race that, you know, if you can get some dogs together and you want to try and make it to Nome, come on. So, I mean, to some degree, it's in flux.
So, Craig, what do you think the public wants? You know, of course, Iditarod wants it to be, you know, shiny and relevant, but what do you think the public wants? Do you think that the public wants this sort of last frontierish outlaw type stuff? You know, you look at other sports, Dennis Rodman in basketball and John Daly in golf, and you know, all these, even Ray Lewis in football. He is revered still, including his, you know, his past transgressions. He's still a revered member of the NFL. So what do you think the public is looking for, not necessarily Iditarod in general?
I that's hard to answer, because for every one of those Ray Lewis guys, there's, you know, some guy with a clean-cut image like Tom Brady, or at least wants a clean-cut
right.
image, but some guy with a clean-cut image like Tom Brady out, you know, working the other end of that spectrum.
Right.
And I think you want both. I mean, I think you want, you know, the NFL goes to great lengths to maintain a wholesome image, but they tolerate a few of these kind of outlaws. And I
right.
don't think there's anything wrong with that, and I think it adds flavor. And at times, I mean, when I look at the Iditarod front runners, I kind of miss Lance, you know, not being there to give that balance, because, I mean, they're kind of homogenized, you know, cut out of the same cookie cutter nice guys. I mean, and they work to be nice guys, and, I mean, there's not, you know, I go way back to Rick Swenson, who I had a really strange relationship with and who I kind of consider a friend, although we don't talk hardly ever anymore. But, I mean, he was kind of this cantankerous on and off, and he and Susan had this, you know, this battle going between the two of them that played. I mean, it made life as a reporter easier. I don't know if that made the story better, but it made it a lot easier to cover because there were these kind of rivalries going on within it that now are much more subdued. And, you know, if they got the perfect race some year, I think it could be just kind of boring.
Exactly. Alex?
Yeah, you know, one of the things that I've noticed, and especially in the past couple of years, is that, as you were saying earlier, the ease of access to information makes it possible to get all sorts of little tidbits from all over the race, from fans, from people following the race, from people in the villages. But it seems to be much harder to actually get real stories and real information that that we as fans really care about. And I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about that. You know, I as great as it is to have Sebastian Schnulli covering the race for Iditarod, I miss having people like you out on the trail doing all of those great back of the pack stories.
Well, I mean, the first part there is, it is a market problem. It's really hard to tell good stories. I mean, people think it's easy, but you know, I've been doing it for a long time. It may be fairly easy for me, but even for me sometimes, it's pretty hard to tell a story, which is something, you know, that has a coherent beginning, middle, and end. I mean, you have to get your head around it. You have to figure out where you're going. It's just not as easy as it looks, whereas just piling up information is, you know, basically is a lot of what you get online. It's people are just taking notes and dumping the notes on there and sort them out as you will. Here's the notes. You know, I don't know what the answer to that is. It's going to be decided by the public. I know when we used to cover, when I first started covering Iditarod, it was, you know, we kind of, Jack London was the model. You kind of wanted those stories. Our philosophy at the old Anchors Daily News was that until the coast, we'd basically cover, you know, the back of the pack, that we really didn't care that much about the race, because it really didn't happen to the coast. Well, all of that's changed as the trails improve. The race now kind of starts in Willow. Everybody's racing from the beginning, so you can't ignore the race, which takes most of your reporting horsepower. And, you know, we've got to keep up with who's going to win this thing because it's a race from the get-go. So there's really nobody who has the staff to cover the back. So those people kind of get overlooked. And in many ways, I mean, they're the best stories. There are a lot of people back there that this is, you know, maybe a once-in-a-lifetime thing, and it's a real struggle for them. I mean, I like those – I hate to use the word like, but I enjoy spending time on the trail with those people more than the people at the front, because it's more of a challenge to them. They're more open. It's a struggle. The people at the front get really irritated with you if you devote a lot of press time to those people at the back. It's a very complicated situation as to why the way it works the way it does. But, you know, sooner or later, the market is going to decide that, whether they want to just watch a race or whether they're interested in the characters in the race. And I think, you know, to me, where Iditarod's missing the bet is that they don't develop the professional players more as characters, and they don't play to those people in the back who may have great backstories.
Alex, are you there?
Yeah, sorry about that. Yeah, that's definitely true. And I know both Robert and I, our hearts are always with the back of the Packers, and we always find it much more interesting to follow them, especially someone who this is it. This is their one time that they're going to do it. I've noticed, especially with some of the more dominant racers right now, that they seem so media savvy these days, and it's far less interesting to watch an interview with someone who's very aware of being interviewed than to listen to somebody who is just being completely honest and vulnerable and speaking from their soul. And I don't find that you get a lot of that from most of the people who are, you know, the very top racers right now.
Yeah, they're pretty packaged, and I don't think the Iditarod helped it with their gag order. I mean, to me, part of the story is when the trail's bad, the trail's bad. I mean, it kind of makes it more interesting, and this idea, you know, we're not going to say anything negative about anything, just kind of struck me as, okay, that just takes half the romance out of the race.
Right. Do you have any sense of why the gag order was put into effect? Was it more about the sponsors or about trying to grow the race? Because
the sponsors were unhappy with people bashing Donlin, which I can understand. I mean, there was some thinking that, you know, the trail breakers feel bad if people say how bad the trail is. There was some blow up after Jeff King shot that first YouTube video of going through Rainy Pass a couple of years ago, and it would look like a nightmare. And, you know, we had the whole debate about someone could get hurt. And I'm like, yeah, someone could get hurt. It's the Iditarod. Of course someone could get hurt. So I don't know exactly where it came from. And I don't think it was any one thing. I think it was a combination of things. Organizationally, a lot of organizations want to do that. They want to control the message, which, you know, in my opinion, at the point we're at now with Facebook and Twitter and everything else out there, it's a giant waste of time to try to control the message, because it's coming out in so many places that, you know, you just kind of end up messing up your product while trying to control the message.
Right, and it seemed like a lot of the mushers weren't really sure what they could say and what they couldn't say, and I would imagine that probably made a lot of them just much more reluctant to say anything at all.
Yeah, well, that was the easiest route, was, you know, when in doubt, say nothing. I mean, I know when I was doing that story on the woman who got grabbed that didn't get reported on the trail between Galena and Koyukuk. There were a couple of rookie mushers who, you know, talked to me and then were like, please, please don't use my name. I mean, they were afraid they were going to lose their official qualifier status, to which I just was kind of like, who would put that kind of fear into somebody, and for what purpose? I mean, it didn't make much sense to me.
Yeah.
So Craig,
you know,
go ahead, Alex.
No, go ahead, Robert.
I was going to say, in regards to that, with that sort of fear of God in you, so to speak, as you mentioned with the two rookies, do you think that that's going to eventually backfire on Iditarod, where, you know, everything, because they already do control everything, with the insider and what they have, what people have access to, other than just, you know, Iditarod.com or whatever they're reading on. Online, they sort of already control everything, and now you have the people that are on the trail that want to say something, good or bad. They're afraid to even speak up. I think that that's going to be more of a hindrance than it is than a help, at least in my opinion.
Well, I tend to share that view. I mean, my personal opinion is, if you have issues of any kind, the longer you keep them bottled up, the more of an explosion there is when they get out. I just assume the Iditarod talk about anything, and including some of its problems that we have. Otherwise, you push these things underground, they don't go away, they just kind of sit there and simmer till they explode, and that would be a bad situation.
Yeah.
One final question from me, Alex, and then I'll let you close out here with Craig. when you were covering the snow machine story earlier in Iditarod, we were about halfway done with the race, and you talked extensively about the problems in the villages and sort of how the race has sort of contained itself in, you know, sort of in mass and then sort of dissipated itself from the villages. Can you tell our listening public about that? Because, you know, many of them, if in fact most of them, do not live up here in Alaska, so they don't have a real taste of what that's all about. Can you sort of explain what you were trying to get across part of your article?
Oh, you really do want to get me in trouble with Iditarod, don't you? It's kind of a very simple problem, which I can put in a broader Alaska context in that, you know, we like to everyone in Alaska likes to refer to everyone from outside as outsiders. And
right.
We kind of, you know, we welcome tourists, but we have this kind of disdain for those people from outside. Well, when the people from Iditarod go to the bush, they're the people from outside. You know, and a lot of them, the way the race has changed, they're there, they're in and out. They really don't have a lot of time for villagers. You know, they might be in the checkpoint a few minutes. It's like, excuse me, I got to get my food, get out of my way. Iditarod knows that, you know, it's kind of like an intrusion in some villages. So it's tried to shorten the race up and run faster. But the problem with that is that, you know, a lot of those people at the back were kind of lollygagging along and had time to talk to villagers and kind of hung out and left money around and did kind of good PR for Iditarod. So we've lost some of those people. I mean, it's a very complicated picture. I can't quite, you know, summarize it in a few seconds. But, I mean, if you're living in some little village in the middle of nowhere where there's really no economy and you look at this thing on the Internet or on TV and you hear all this talk about the multimillion-dollar Iditarod race, blah, 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 and it shows up in your village, your natural reaction is, what are we getting out of this? And the reality is the villages don't get much of anything out of it except, you know, visitors for a week. So there's that and the fact that there's no real dog mushing community left in a lot of villages. It's a tough situation.
I agree.
You know,
Alex,
Craig,
we have about 2 minutes left.
Okay, Craig, I was going to ask a similar question. I know that a lot of these things are really complicated and aren't things that we can solve in the next 90 seconds. But if you were suddenly tomorrow in charge of Iditarod, are there, you know, two or three things that you can think of that you would want to implement that would be a top priority if you had all of the resources of the organization and could set the, you know, the direction?
Well, if I had all the resources in the world, and if I had total control, the first thing I would do is I would get the Iditarod, the Iron Dog Dog Race, and the Iditarod Invitational, which is the human-powered bike and run race, under one roof so that I had a bigger footprint as a sports organization. Then I would start developing them all as personalities so that, you know, you could grow all of them into something, you know, that would benefit Alaska more. And then I would try to get as many people involved as I could in outreach to the villages, whether it's getting people out there before these races to talk to school kids, whether it's, you know, going out there to teach snow machine safety lessons, whether it's going on training runs where you can spend some time and, you know, give some kids a dog sled ride. You know, I would try and organize some kind of community relations program, but all of that takes money. And that money, you got to grow the organization. So now we're back to, you know, we need to put something together that all of these people who have a little bit of money can work together to use what they have and grow some more money so they can start to do those things.
Lofty goals for sure. Alex, we're just about out of time here with Craig. Craig, craigmedred.news is your website. Every day there's very interesting articles. I'm a pretty avid reader of your stuff. I even was a big fan of yours when you were back at the ADN several years ago. Anything else you want to plug while you're here, Craig? Any other ways?
No, just read the website. Feel free to contribute.
That's the important
part. No, I mean,
you know,
I enjoyed it. You two guys have probably gotten me in even more trouble with Iditarod. Some people think if you say anything about, you know, Iditarod that's not positive, you hate the race. Well, you know, it's not the case. I the highlight of my year every year is being out on that trail, and I'm usually out there for that Iditarod Invitational before the dog race starts, because that's become the most enjoyable time to be out there. But, you know, I love that trail. I think everybody who's been on it loves that trail. And, you know, it's a kind of a question of talking about the problems in order to solve them.
Exactly.
Right.
You know, that's why we wanted to have you on today, Craig, is to get another view. You know, Alex and I sit here and talk about our view of the show, mine in the Musher's perspective, and Alex is more from a fan's perspective. So it was good to have a different view. And of course, everybody has their opinions, good or bad, and I think you're one of the top voices, at least in terms of upfront news, at least here in Alaska, from my opinion. So I do want to thank you very much for being on the show today, and keep up the good work, and we'll continue to read on, okay?
Well, thank you, guys.
Thanks, Craig.
Thank you. On behalf of my co-host today, Alex Stein, and our guest, Craig Medred, we'll talk to you guys next time. Goodbye.